Okay, so I'd like to introduce Seth Tomlinson, who is our guest this evening, who is our presenting. Seth is an acoustician with the Greenbush Group, contributed to multiple projects involving sewage treatment facilities, education facilities, hospitals, and multifamily dwellings and design data acquisition according to appropriate standards and data analysis. And I can read this description right off the web. You probably already read that. So I'll let Seth give us more kind of self-introduction, if you will, and get out of the way and let the session continue. So,
okay.
Seth, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So I'm an acoustician with the Greenbush Group. I've been there for 7 years now. We deal a lot with noise codes, helping people meet the local noise ordinances. I've done a lot of racetracks, dog parks. I've seemed to be pretty common. The other thing we run into a lot is HVAC equipment. We'll talk about some noise codes. I studied physics and acoustics at Brigham Young University. Also, a legal disclaimer, I wouldn't advise anyone to take anything I say tonight as legal advice. And also, this presentation was not put together by me. This presentation was put together by my boss, Julie Weebush Wells. Credit goes to her for this. We'll get right into it. If anyone has questions while we're going, feel free to shoot those out, and kind of informally, we'll just go through here. And all right, cities and towns are not merely a collection of projects and developments mixed with infrastructure, but a tapestry which forms the setting of life. So this is a quote that Julie likes. The point being that sound is one of those things that weaves into that tapestry, creates a setting for our lives. When you talk to someone, we recently moved, and so, one thing we always ask people, who lived in the neighborhood we were thinking about moving to is, like, what's it sound like there? Is it, are you close to the freeway? Are your neighbors rowdy, So I think we can all identify with that. The U.S. was a world leader in noise control policies back 50 now years ago. In 1976, the need for nationwide noise policy in the U.S. was acknowledged, and the Committee on Environmental Quality issued the first report in 1968. They proposed a federal program for noise abatement, and in 1972, the Noise Control Act of 1972 was enacted, also known as the Noise Pollution and Abatement Act of 1972. Other agencies, the FAA, the FHWA, Department of Defense, they kind of followed suit when this came into being. In 1978, Congress passed the Quiet Communities Act, and funding of research continued to go on. but in 1982, funding for noise research and noise control and even, funding for the policy and the people who were implementing the policy was cut off. So there really hasn't been much change in noise policy since the early 80s. the Noise Control Act was the most controversial of these policies, had both successes and failures. One success was that it had, actually some research and science behind it. And it started a lot of noise control type stuff rolling as far as ordinances and codes. It was considered a failure, however, at controlling noise levels from typical sources because FAA and many rulings, kind of EPA and FAA, kind of had a history of, you know, butting heads on noise, and FAA won every time. Basically the FAA, you know, said we need to make as much noise as we need to make, you know, in order to get people from place to place, and the courts agreed with that for the most part. Kind of the same thing with FHWA and rail as well. So, like I said, since the 80s, there hasn't really been much progress on noise research as federally, at a federal level, or noise ordinances, noise code. most community ordinances, including Washington State's, are still based on the Noise Control Act of 72, the model that they had. That's true at the state level as well as the community level. Usually you'll see at the community level, cities or counties, they'll reference the Washington State code, which is, again, based on the Noise Control Act of 72. A lot of codes are poorly written, ill-defined. There's a lot of ambiguity and interpretation that goes on with these codes. There's almost no funding at any level for people to enforce these codes, or, you know, it's usually farmed off to another department that's doing something else. For instance, at the state level, the Department of Ecology is in charge of enforcing the noise ordinances, and they don't have any noise people. And, you know, if you wanted to make a change to a local ordinance, you know, you submit those to the state, and they have 90 days to comment, and if they don't comment, then it's automatically approved. I've been privy to a couple of those times when people have, you know, submitted something to change their local ordinance to the state, and the state never comments. It's always just goes to the 90 days and approved by default after the 90 days.
Before you leave that point, are you saying a local jurisdiction proposes something or citizens propose something?
A local jurisdiction.
Okay.
Right.
And what was that for the classes of noise that got this all started? Are we talking about airports in particular? Are we talking about factories? Are we talking about highways? I mean, something got this all started that people wound up.
Right. The impetus is really the transportation noise, which again is, you know, why a lot of this was considered a failure, because, you know, the impetus being transportation noise, you know, highways, airport noise, and rail noise, you know, and the regulations ended up not having, you know, really any authority over those noise sources. I think Julie has been on this committee. I have not, but you know, people have volunteered to, you know, ASA and ANSI and other organizations have, you know, tried to get the process going of, you know, revising noise codes and making them better. I don't know if any of you have been on boards for, you know, making and revising standards, but there can be a lot of infighting and revision after revision after revision. So those things have moved slowly and really not come to much fruition. a bill that you know is introduced every year, the Quiet Communities Act of 2005, introduced to Congress every year and never passed. So there's not a lot of...
What does that say?
Sorry?
Generally, what does that propose?
I don't know.
Who introduces it?
Again, I don't know. Sorry. Some of this stuff, you know, again, this is Julie's presentation, so some of the stuff in here I'm not as quite knowledgeable about. As I stated earlier, the current enforcement agency for the Washington noise ordinance is the Department of Ecology. They're not funded for noise. They don't have any interest or expertise in the subject. We have another office in Ohio, and again, Julie would know more about the Ohio stuff, but apparently the EPA in Ohio does not even have any noise regulations. So again, basically, local jurisdictions are basically free to enact whatever they liked. The standard being, you know, whatever they submit to the DOE just, you know, is approved by default after 90 days. So noise control codes come in basically two flavors. One is what we call a nuisance code, and that is basically, you know, don't make any noise that bothers anyone. Here's a laundry list of things that may annoy people. So a lot of times you'll see, you know, barking dogs on that list, amplified music on that list. Shouting is interesting because sometimes some codes specifically, you know, include, you know, shouting or raucous behavior on that list. Some codes specifically exempt it as a form of free speech. And the other flavor of noise codes is one that either, you know, references the state ordinance, which is based again on the Noise Control Act of 1972, or basically takes that same thing and copies it into their code. So this is what the Washington Administrative Code sound level limits are. So we have what they call the EDNA, which stands for Environmental Designation for Noise Abatement. So Class A is basically residential, Class B is basically commercial, and Class C would be industrial. So if I'm in my house and I'm making noise that, you know, may bother my neighbors at the property line, you know, that the level of noise would have to be 55 dBA or less, or I would be in violation of this code. If I was, you know, a commercial property adjacent to a residential property, I'd get 2 decibels on top of that. And if I was industrial next to a residential zone, then I'd have 3 decibels on top of that. So you can kind of see how that chart works. The maximum level, the levels that of sound that you're allowed to make are reduced by 10 decibels when the receiving property is Class A. So taking into consideration that, you know, for a residentially zoned area, you know, people are typically trying to sleep at night, and that applies from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. And then, so within any hour, these levels may be exceeded by 5 dBA for a total of 15 minutes, or 10 dBA for a total of 5 minutes, or 15 dBA for a total of 1.5 minutes. that can be, there's a lot of nuance in there that creates a lot of difficulty sometime in, you know, predicting, you know, whether an establishment will be in violation of this code. The thing we run into a lot is, you know, if I have an emergency generator and I need to exercise it every week or every month or whatever it is, If I run it for just 15 minutes, if that exercise period can be restricted to just 15 minutes, then I can, you know, exceed this level by 5.
I was hoping when Seattle came up with the vague noise ordinance, if you could hear it 75 feet away, it was too noisy, that they'd take the freeway out.
Yeah, the freeways actually, again, are under a different, so this doesn't apply to freeways.
Talk about some of the things that are exempt from these levels.
Okay, I actually brought the Seattle code with me, so I'll read the exemptions. The following are exempt from the provisions of this chapter at all times: sounds originating from aircraft in flight, and sounds that originate at airports and are directly related to flight operations. Sounds created by safety and protective devices such as relief valves, where noise suppression would defeat the safety release intent of the device. Sounds created by fire alarms. Sounds created by emergency equipment and emergency work necessary in the interest of law enforcement or of the health, safety, and welfare of the community. Sounds created by natural phenomenon. Excuse me. Sounds originating from forest harvesting and silviculture activity and from commercial agriculture if the receiving property is located in a commercial or industrial district of the city. Sounds created by auxiliary equipment on motor vehicles while used for highway surface maintenance. And sounds created by warning devices or alarms not operated continuously for more than 30 minutes per incident. The following sounds are exempt during daytime hours only. Sounds created by bells, chimes, or carillons not operating for more than 5 minutes in any hour. Unamplified sounds originating from officially sanctioned parades and other public events. Sounds created by the discharge of firearms on legally established shooting ranges. Sounds created by blasting. And sounds originating from forest harvesting and silviculture activity from commercial agriculture. The list of exemptions varies from, again, county to county, city to city. Those are pretty typical exemptions that we run into. Electrical substations is one that a lot of people complain about that's also typically exempt.
How about windmills?
I've never run into windmills personally, but that sounds like something that...
It's very controversial right now.
But he was reading from a list of City of Seattle.
Understood.
And windmills are not allowed in the city, are they?
No, I was just in general windmills.
Yeah, that would be a good one to look into. Like I said, I haven't personally run into windmills, but I do know that it's a big issue for people that are close to them.
I saw that there's the time, the qualification of the time limits here. It made me wonder, is it specified whether this is SBO, effective SBO, or?
Yeah, this is this would be, so the way that there's some ambiguity there.
Okay.
So the way that we typically interpret this are the levels in the table there are hourly LEQ. So the average A-weighted level over an hour.
For the state. The city is averaged over a minute.
Right. That's right. And some jurisdictions have a definition for how long you should measure, where you should measure. I think we'll get to Tacoma here. Tacoma says you should measure at least 30 seconds in three different places. Typically, if we're making a measurement to determine compliance, it won't be for an hour, because typically we're measuring something that's assumed to be, constant over the hour, so we can just take a 1 minute LEQ and say, well, that's what it would be for the hour as well.
Can you define LEQ for people who might not know that term?
Yeah, LEQ basically is an average sound level, so you may The sound level obviously is going to vary throughout, you know, an hour or even a minute. So the LEQ, basically, you can think of as the average for that hour.
Is LEQ an acronym?
Yes, it stands. L is level, so there's many descriptors, and so an L max or an L min would be the L stands for level, which is implied the sound pressure level in decibels, which is what that L means. So L max would be the maximum level, you know, in a specified time period. Min would be the minimum. LEQ would be, again, that average. There's lots of other descriptors. LDN, there's statistical descriptors that are, you know, LO5 would be the level that is exceeded 5% of the time. L50 would be the level that's exceeded 50% of the time. And that's typically what we'd use to determine these time exceedances thing here. So we'd use, see if I can remember the way we do it. We use an L25. I'm going to have to, I'm drawing a blank here. But let's see, L25, L08, L02, and L max are what we'd use to figure out, you know, what's exceeded 15 minutes out of the hour, 5 minutes out of the hour, 1.5 minutes out of the hour, and so on.
I can make a comment. I've done this kind of work before, and the measurements that you're taking don't mean anything if you're not using a calibrated instrument. So typically, if you are using a measurement device that is calibratable, then you would typically find all these functions would be present in that device. So it's not like you have to take a bunch of measurements and write it down and figure it all out. You just set the instrument and tell it which L type of reading you're doing, and then you just, you know, hit go, and then it just does it.
Right. I'm told in the old days, before my time, that you did actually have to, you know, go through octave by octave and write down numbers for each, you know, minute or whatever, and then do the math later. But yeah, now we just say go. So that's nice.
Are there any reasonably priced meters that do that?
Yeah. I think the cheapest you'd get for a calibrated meter that'll do at least an LEQ and an L max and an L min is probably around $100.
There
is an app for your phone.
Unless you had the calibrated mic at that, like the iAudio interface, for example, that allows you to use a calibrated microphone.
Most codes have something written into them. That defines, you know, that a measurement must be taken with a type 2 meter or better. And ANSI describes those, you know, what's a type 2 meter, what's a type 1 meter. So there's requirements for the filters and the integration and for the, you know, microphone response and all those things.
If you call Al Banker, you know Al, right? Call him. He's got one that he picked up, I think, for like $150 that does all this stuff. It's really nice. And that was the one that I was using, was Al's.
Can you tell us the brand?
I don't remember. That's what I'm saying. I know Dan knows Al, so I'm just saying, you know, call him and he can recommend one that's perfectly kind of portable. You can get a nice little calendar before it does all the stuff. And it's admissible.
So here's again Seattle Municipal Code. Looks a whole lot like the WAC code, like Washington Administrative Code. So and that's typical. We see a lot of codes that look just like this. Seattle also has some interesting provisions for construction equipment. Construction's, again, one of those things that's typically exempt. or may be exempt or may have special conditions applied to it. Festivals, we just put out a proposal for noise monitoring at Bumper Shoot. Typically those are would have some kind of a variance. For Seattle, the Department of Planning and Development, DPD, does noise. And the way that they have figured out what their variance is, you know, they'll have the venue and they'll say, crank it up until we can hear it at some location, and that's your maximum. another thing, typically those variances will apply at the mixing station, so there'll be someone monitoring there at the mixing board. Bumper Shoot also monitors before and during the event in the surrounding community, so that they can say, you know, if someone has a complaint, then they can say, well, you know, on this day before the event at this time, it was, you know, it was only 55, and the event, it was, you know, 56, so you weren't really that impacted, or, you know, maybe it was even lower. A few examples of things that are kind of quirky in a few codes. So I'll just go ahead and read this. This is an example of, you know, sometimes whatever agency is getting, the agency will employ, you know, some expert to help them write their noise code. Sometimes those experts write themselves into the code. So for the purposes of this chapter, an employee representing an authorized enforcement agency shall be considered qualified to make noise measurements and enforce the state's department, state's noise rules or municipal noise ordinance approved by the department, as the case may be, if such a person completes every 2 years a noise certification course, which is Cook College, Rutgers, the state university, which is offered by the Department of Environmental Sciences of Cook College, Rutgers, the state university. So you occasionally run into that, especially on the East Coast. That seems more common to see, you know, where someone has written themselves into the code.
Is there anything like that in Washington?
No. The code in Washington says that it has some type of a qualification for who can make noise ordinances, but it's pretty vague and open to interpretation. It's something like, you know, someone who is qualified to make noise measurements shall make the noise measurements. So again, here's Tacoma, and Tacoma just recently rewrote their code, and it's really quirky now. theirs is based on a maximum level, an L max rather than an LEQ. That's really untypical. They have a indoor and outdoor code, DBA and DBC. That's again really not typical. And again, so rather than having a level that you know, a threshold that can't be exceeded, theirs is based on whatever ambient is. So whatever ambient is, you can't be so far above that, which, you know, in some cases may create, you know, an ever escalating sound level.
Is DBA biased to allow more low frequency sound?
Yes. So,
is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I think it's a bad thing.
It could be, depending on your perspective, it could be either a good thing or a bad thing. If you want to make low frequency sound, that's a good thing for you. So the DBA curve is supposed to represent kind of the sensitivity of human hearing around 40 DBA. DBC represents human hearing at a level higher than that, and now I can't remember what DBC is.
70.
That's what I wanted to say. and it is a flatter curve, so if you look at the DBA versus the DBC curve, the lower frequencies are much more weighted out in the DBA curve. So DBC is good for people, you know, next to nightclubs and whatnot that or whatever might be making low frequency sound.
This looks unenforceable.
A lot of codes are unenforceable. A lot of the problem comes down to who's going to enforce the code. Again, most jurisdictions don't have any noise people. Or if they do, you know, it's one thing that they've kind of been assigned among, you know, the other thing that they really do. So, you know, we're hired a lot by, you know, jurisdictions and by, you know, people who want to make sure they're meeting code to help understand, you know, what the code means and how we can meet it.
What about F?
F?
Yeah. Measurements shall be taken in 3 30-second intervals within a 30-minute period. Does that mean consecutively?
Right.
Does that mean spaced out over 10-minute intervals? You know, if you call the police, are the police going to stand there for half an hour while they wait for you to take the last reading?
Right. And that's one thing we run into with codes is police have absolutely no interest in carrying a sound meter or being trained in how to use a sound meter. That's why you run into a lot of, you know, codes that are written, you know, audible at so many feet, is because a policeman can actually come out there and say, aha, I hear it, and I'm standing 50 feet away, rather than, you know, having to read a meter. And, you know, even if, you know, you do have someone out there with a meter, you know, if a truck runs by, are they gonna, you know, be savvy enough to say, well, that was the truck and not, you know, this other source that's in question there, because, you know, the meter just spits out a number, right? So, yeah, there's a lot of nuance, ambiguity, and lack of funding and knowledge in these things.
And when it talks about the ambient sound level, and this one does too, this slide does too, is that a momentary phenomenon, or is that an ongoing phenomenon? So if I measure when the truck is going by, I can have a much louder noise going than I can after the truck is gone and all traffic is quiet for 30 seconds.
Right. That's a very good question, and I think that's kind of what the 30-second intervals over a 30-minute, within a 30-minute period is kind of trying to address, is, you know, hopefully I won't have a truck going by in each of those 30 seconds.
It's totally subject to abuse by the enforcer, right? Because if some enforcer was out to get somebody, they could pick the moment, the 30-second intervals, when nothing is happening.
Right.
And really hurt somebody.
Yeah, and...
Or if they wanted to let them go, they could pick the noisy moments.
Right. Typically what we do, if we're trying to establish an ambient, we like to set out a meter for at least 48 hours, and then we can say, you know, again, a lot of these descriptors come in, we can say, well, is it appropriate to, you know, look at the day-night level, or, you know, the LEQ for this 1 hour where we're concerned about. But yeah, ambient fluctuates for sure. And so there's, again, a lot of nuance in there.
You mentioned something just a little bit ago. You said that the meter just spits out a number. Somewhere through your slide deck, will you be relating how the spectra can influence that number and how some spectra may be more annoying than other spectra?
That is not addressed here, but that is a good point. A lot of the code, most of the codes you'll see have a penalty for impulsive, what they call impulsive noise, tonal noise, and what they call repetitive noise. So that's kind of trying to take that into consideration. Usually a tonal noise is more annoying than a broadband noise. So typically it's a 5 dB penalty, so if whatever noise someone is making is considered tonal, and usually they'll have a definition, which typically has to do, they'll say, you know, if looking at third octave bands, if you look at the two octave bands adjacent to one band, and if the middle band between those three bands is so many dB higher, then it's considered tonal, which may or may not actually be tonal to your ear. And then, again, they'll have definitions for what they consider impulsive noise or repetitive noise. So Julie actually worked with the city of Spokane in helping to develop their noise code. There's a lot of, you know, politics in writing these codes, and, you know, Julie experienced some, you know, difficulty in getting them to write a code that actually made sense. So I don't know if a lot of times, I don't know if any of you who have been consultants have run into this, but, you know, a lot of times you have trouble convincing the people who hired you for your expert opinion to actually take that opinion. So, again, another example of something that's kind of quirky. Sounds associated with the exercise of constitutionally protected expressive activities which do not exceed the ambient sound level, where the activities occur by 10 dBA for outdoor activities and 6 dBA for indoor activities between the hours of 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. Between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., the decibel readings above the ambient level shall be reduced to 5 dBA for outdoor activities and 3 dBA for indoor activities. Constitutionally protected expressive activities shall include performers as defined in Spokane Municipal Code. The content of the activity shall not be considered in determining a violation. So,
I'm just not able to understand the first sentence. It doesn't seem to complete.
Yeah, I'm with you. I really can't make heads or tails of it.
There's a phrase missing at the end.
Yeah. So, again, just another example of.
And I want to know how they're going to reduce the ambient level by 5.
Right.
I'd like to see that one myself.
So, you know, even when, you know, I guess this is an example, you know, that Julie was showing us that, you know, politics overrules common sense in a lot of cases. So. I'm not exactly sure how this came about, but...
Is this paragraph in the context of something saying this is what's allowed, or this is what's disallowed?
Yeah, I believe this is in the context, again, of that free speech problem where, you know, sometimes codes want to say, well, no yelling, and some codes want to say, well, that's free speech. So this is kind of trying to, I think, draw a middle ground between those two extremes of saying, you know, no yelling and yelling is free speech. So.
But as Steve pointed out, there's a phrase missing in that first one. So is the phrase in the previous section of this where it says...
Is there an inference or an implication that links
prohibited
that?
Prohibited activities, colon, sounds associated with the exercise of constitutionally, which do not exceed where the activities occur.
Yeah, there's no verb in there.
So that's permitted.
Yeah.
Again, I have a hard time making heads or tails of this, and I don't have the full context of it, so I can't really give you a good answer, unfortunately.
I think the good answer is that this is another example of it means what they want it to mean at any given time.
Right, and that's another thing you run into a lot with noise codes is, you know, I've worked on projects where, you know, the official is obviously misinterpreting what the code was intended to mean, and, you know, you can't argue too hard with the person who's approving the project, you know.
Yeah.
So sometimes you just kind of have to, you know, bite the bullet a little bit and say, okay, we'll do that, even though, you know, that's not right. Portland is kind of an exception to a lot of the rules. They actually have noise people, and they're pretty good about enforcing their noise code. The thing that's interesting about their noise code is that they give octave band levels that can't be exceeded. So going back to Bob's comment, that's... Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, we have an office in Franklin, Ohio. So this is an instance of a nuisance noise ordinance that, you know, no person shall use, operate, or permit to be played any radio, receiving or set, musical instrument, or other sound amplification system for the producing or reproducing of sound in such a manner as to disturb the peace, quiet, and comfort of such neighboring inhabitants. And then the largest offender of this is a commercial establishment, J.D. Legend, who holds outdoor rock and roll concerts heard for miles. An apartment building is within 100 feet. But, you know, someone on the city council has a hand in that business, so they just choose to ignore it.
This here's Ohio.
Yeah. So nightlife. Julie was involved in what they called the. I think it's coming up on one of these sites. I think it's the Nightlife Advisory Board. Yeah. So the problem is, these nightclubs, they want to make a lot of noise because, you know, if you're walking down the block and trying to choose which one to go into, you want to go into one that's pumping, right? And there's been multiple studies that have shown that alcohol consumption increases with noise level. So,
can I comment to that?
Sure.
Should also be noted that the threshold for permanent ear damage is decreased as you drink more alcohol and also when you're exposed to secondhand cigarette smoke or if you're smoking yourself. So if you think what level you can safely listen to for a certain amount of time, you can throw that out the window the minute you start drinking and or smoking.
You say the threshold is decreased or increased?
Decreased.
Decreased,
okay.
The
more you drink and the more you're exposed to tobacco smoke, the lower the level has to be for a shorter period of time before you will experience permanent ear damage.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, could that also be due to fatigue? We did some articulation testing with jet aircraft, thinking that the longer people were exposed to a certain level of noise, it lowered their ability to hear speech. Articulation testing, I think is what we called it. Is that different than what you're saying?
Mm-hmm, because I'm talking about permanent ear damage.
Yeah. Okay. There is damping at excessive noise levels.
So but there's fatigue if it's prolonged. Yeah.
So the point being, I guess these establishments, they want to make a lot of noise, and their revenue depends on being able to make a lot of noise. And this is something the city, you know, wants to, you know, this is, you know, economic. This has some economic value, so it's something they want to foster as, you know, an economic driver, but at the same time, they don't want to, you know, annoy everybody. So Seattle mayor signed an ordinance addressing amplified nightlife in 2007. The Seattle City Council appointed 9 members to a nightlife advisory board, included 3 music and nightlife industries, 3 downtown neighborhoods, 1 law enforcement, 1 Washington State Liquor Control Board, and 1 acoustical consultant. goal was to, again, they want to support the industry and maintain the economic contribution, and at the same time ensure that the neighborhoods are livable and strike a balance between effective and sustainable balance. So the goal of the board was to develop some recommendations to improve conditions for both the nightlife and the neighbors, to provide some advice, but to do it without developing any new regulations for the nightclubs. The idea being that, you know, as they were a part of this board, that they would kind of make the good faith effort to comply with the recommendations without having to codify any regulations. So they found that Section 16 of the ordinance needed some clarification. Again, run into, you know, ambiguities, nuance in the language. Needed to clarify what plainly audible to a person of normal hearing and when measured inside a receiving dwelling unit meant. Needed to set DBA and DBC thresholds to allow them to exceed what would regularly be the code, and to look at how the restrictions might vary depending on where you are within the city.
I wanted to point out perhaps what might not be obvious from implementation measured inside a receiving dwelling unit, because that will vary on a unit-to-unit basis, even if they nominally appear to be the same distance or even in the same structure. I worked with Chop Suey on some noise abatement issues that they had, and we thought we had a pretty good handle of what was going on there, but it turned out that we had one unit which was across the street and not directly across the street, that was downstairs in an apartment building that happened to be the exact location and the exact physical shape and square footage that it was a resonant chamber for bass. So if you took a measurement anywhere else around that area or in any other unit in that apartment building, we were totally well within compliance. Mm-hmm. But you go into that guy's place, and it was boom, boom city. So we had to go back and do some additional stuff to get that under control.
You didn't buy him some bass traps, huh?
No.
Cut a hole in the wall.
We just had to tighten up the building even more. But you can stand outside the building, and you heard the traffic noise more than you heard a show could be going on inside, full tilt. We got it to the point where you could stand on the sidewalk right outside the wall, not hear what was going on. But in that guy's apartment, that was a good 100 feet away or more. It was just, it was a party in there.
Yeah. That's interesting. So I took part in some of these measurements. We measured levels near different nightclubs, over the weekends. This is hard to read, but you can see some of these descriptors here. The red line is the exterior LEQ. The green line is the exterior LMAX. The blue line is the exterior LMIN. And the orange line is the interior LEQ.
What's the time base?
Let's see. The scale on the bottom is each number here is 2 hours. Yeah.
The interior is in what?
Inside a dwelling. Yeah.
A dwelling.
Yeah. So yeah, and you can see I don't know if you can read again, but the on the top there, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So it gives you, again, an idea of the time scale there. Again, some of the results from these measurements. Locations, measurement date, DBA and DBC levels. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with any of these neighborhoods or locations, but give you a second to absorb that. So the recommendations that came out from the board: 55 DBA, 65 DBC in residential neighborhoods, 70 and 80 in urban centers with some exceptions. Defined a measurement location as, let's see, one of those words got, I forget what that word is. I think it's vent. Anyways, 6 feet from the exterior of the establishment, average not less than 2 minutes, six, and at the weakest transmission point, so the doors or the glass or ventilation. Establish a protocol where it's explicit that, you know, other intermittent noises such as traffic, sirens, etc., would be excluded from the measurement. And where two establishments are in close proximity, if needed, you tell one to be quiet so we can measure this guy. And then they tell this guy to be measured so we can measure the other guy. Additional recommendations were to modify the building code so that developers would account for you know, the needed extra acoustical insulation where they might be in mixed use facilities where you know, a lot of times they'll have a commercial space on the bottom with residences on top, and sometimes that ends up being a bar or something where they want to have live music, so they would need to take that into account and beef up the construction a little bit where you know, nightlife might occur, and where, you know, the buildings where it was occurring themselves to require this STC 65. And to give police more authority to cite drunk and disorderly behavior. Further recommendations to not base the criteria on plainly audible to a person of normal hearing. There's just too much ambiguity in that language. Basically, you know, unenforceable or highly abusable, depending on, you know, whoever's enforcing it, whatever they want to do. More defensible noise threshold levels as multiple sources of sound in inner city and heavy low frequency component complicate the sources. So in July 2010, the action was to make the permissible level 80 dBC when measured inside the receiving location with all the doors and windows closed. And that was later changed to 65 dBC. 80 would be pretty disturbing if you were trying to sleep.
What was that in that basement apartment, Daniel? What was it measuring in that basement apartment?
I don't recall. That was several years ago. But it was... it was painfully obvious the minute we walked in. We didn't even have to whip out the meter. You know, it was like, oh yeah, you're not kidding now.
Could you go back one slide and talk about the December thing?
I don't know. Maybe you know more about it, but my understanding is, you know, again, given these recommendations, this is what came out of it. So, you know, the whatever we get in the code doesn't always, you know, reflect very much at all what, you know, the board had recommended. So
was that passed? 65 dBC.
Let's see. I don't know.
What does it mean by it looks like it?
I think it was.
There's a big difference between 80 and 65.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think there'd be a lot of complaints at 80 between July and December? And they would go, oh, well, yeah.
That's what I imagine, yeah. I don't know how 80 ended up in there. That seems
awesome.
Yeah. Awesome or ridiculous, again, depending on if you want to make noise or if you don't like noise. but I imagine, yeah, I can only imagine that there was a lot of complaints. And
is the difference that the other one is for unamplified events, parades, and the like?
No, I believe it's the same. It was 80, and they lowered it to 65. Oh, okay. So amplified sound measured inside a receiving property, they said 80 dBc is okay, and then they came back and said, wait, 65. Yeah. So, yeah,
it's
a lot of...
It's amplified because that means if you're drunk out on the street screaming and yelling, it's a separate issue.
Right. complaints are not always centered around code issues. I would say, but more often than not, annoyance. A lot of times, you know, we get a lot of calls, you know, from, you know, neighbors who are just in a spat and... you know, it really doesn't have, you know, much to do with the noise code other than, you know, I don't like my neighbor so much. but yeah, we get a lot of complaints about waterfall features that somebody's installed. You know, if you don't like your neighbors, go ahead and put that waterfall feature in. Nightlife. Fitness, again, this is a lot, this occurs a lot where we have a mixed-use building. A lot of times the bottom floor is a fitness center, and people are dropping weights and doing their cardio to loud music and bothering the residents who live above it. Coffee grinders and steamers, dogs barking. Again, I've done quite a few. The kind of the trend for dogs now is rather than to kennel your dog, if you need, you know, a dog babysitter, as you, they have kind of free range now, which neighbors don't like, again.
You know, it's interesting you bring up inside of a building, because it seems like that would get really, really complicated to try to regulate you know, noise inside of a building. And it seemed just, first blush, it seems that building would have its own policy or something, but I guess.
Right. A lot of multifamily buildings will have STC and IIC requirements, which has to do with airborne sound insulation and basically stepping on the floor sound insulation between residences. It's actually codified in the Seattle Building Code, and a lot of building codes it is. But it applies between residences and not between a commercial and a residence. So again, it's kind of a hole in the code. If we're designing, you know, a building, then we're certainly take that into account. But yeah, you're right. As far as and even, you know, the what's codified is, you know, meant to insulate. It's kind of a minimum requirement for, you know, I can live normally and not bother my neighbors too much. So you could still meet that with a commercial establishment and have a residence above that was, you know, really impacted, because it's a more of a level reduction than it is a threshold at the receiver.
I can see another problem in this as well, and that is the orientation here seems to be around the concept of single offender, which may not be the case. It could be that somebody gets singled out because they were the last one to add their noise on top of everything else that was already there. So then what do you do? Percentage of liability?
Right. Yeah, we run into a lot, you know, let's go measure, you know, how much noise you're making and see if, you know, you meet the code, but the ambient level is already above the code. So that happens a lot, and that's partly like the Tacoma code. What, you know, that's meant to address is, well, rather than sitting here and saying, well, I can't measure how much noise you're making because, you know, the ambient level is already above the code, that, again, if we say, well, you can be above ambient, whatever ambient is, you can't be, you can be no more than five above that. So, Yeah.
It's like a curve.
And we actually run into that a lot with our clients. Is, you know, we say, well, you got to meet code. It's, you know, 45 at nighttime, and they're saying, well, it's 60 here all the time. Why do we got to meet 45? Well, that's the way the code is written. So yeah. And I believe that's it. Is there any other questions or?
I don't know what you guys. It sounds like you guys do get called out on just neighbors, you know, annoying each other. It seems like it gets really complicated at that level.
Yeah, typically, you know, we'll kind of. Typically, you know, a single, you know, residence, a lot of times we'll kind of try to give them a break, but a lot of times our fees are cost prohibitive for just, you know, regular Joe Schmo. Yeah. So a lot of times we'll just kind of try to guide them through it over the phone and say, you know, try to bring your neighbor some cookies and you'd be surprised at how far that can go.
Well, because it's subjective. I've recently had the experience of writing code for our house. I have a 12-year-old daughter, and so Justin Bieber and One Direction have a 10 dB. but if it's jazz, they can go up another 10 dB.
Sure. Sure.
And her stereo always has to be 20 dB below mine. So maybe I can have you guys come out and do some measurements.
I'd be happy to, yeah. So yeah, dogs barking is an interesting one because you can, a dog's bark is, so you run into the problem where the code is written, you know, you can exceed the level so many dB if you're, you know, if you only are making noise for so many minutes. A dog's bark is very short in duration. You can fit a lot of dog barks into even a minute and a half. So we've run into some interesting situations there with that part of the code. But, yeah.
What about Harleys? What if your neighbor, you know, works third shift, takes his Harley to work every night?
Motor vehicles are, again, regulated by federal highway rather than this noise restriction on the highway. On state roads, they're regulated by a different code than this, but again, the state code has there's a different standard for motor vehicles than this. So if the Harley is on the road, he's okay because that vehicle, well, he's theoretically okay unless he's made some kind of modification, because theoretically the manufacturer has already cleared the noise ordinance with the you know, the manufacturers have to show that they're meeting the federal highway standards. But if he's on his property and, you know, revving his engine, doing repairs or something, then this would come into play.
Okay. What about in the city when you have the collection of 20 dentists on Harley's all over a restaurant?
Again, if they're on the road, they're okay.
In the city, at a stoplight in downtown.
Yeah, as long as they're driving on the road, they're okay, assuming, you know, there's restrictions for mufflers, so you can't take the muffler off of your vehicle, and that's not legal as far as the noise regulation for vehicles is concerned. And the way they do the test is, you know, drive by at, you know, between a certain speed, and you have to meet this level. And, you know, the manufacturers show that they're meeting that level, and then they're street legal. So as long as they're on the street, they're legal.
Yeah, I think what you're saying there is if you're pulled over and the officer saw that your exhaust was modified or something like that, I guess, I don't know if it's a traffic violation at that point or what it is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I mean, we kind of don't deal with that. I'm sure a police officer could give you a ticket if they had seen that you had taken your muffler off.
That reminds me, you mentioned that you you guys work with racetracks. Were you guys involved with the Pacific Raceways down in Auburn?
We've made some measurements down there, but that was before my time. We did a lot of work for PIR in Portland. And I worked on racetracks in Bremerton and one other place on the peninsula. Now I can't remember where it was. But again, you can imagine there's a lot of, you know, a lot of politics involved with that. There's a lot of people who, you know, really love racing. And, you know, we'll swear up and down, you know, how much of an economic boon it's going to be for the community. And then, there's neighbors who are going to be close to the racetrack that just fight tooth and nail to make sure it doesn't happen. So
sometimes it's the PA at the racetrack, not the cars, that become the problem. Remember years ago at SIR, there was an event that I was working a corner at, and the people who were doing the sound said that they were getting this complaint from somebody who lived like 5 miles away. They were hearing the PA, and they drove out there, and sure enough, it was clear as bell at this guy's house. It just happened to be bouncing just right across the and they moved the speakers a little bit, and the complaint disappeared.
Who issues the variances for one-off concerts or concert series within the city limits?
Within Seattle is DPD.
That would be an obvious example. A weekly concert in the summer.
Right. Within the city of Seattle, it's the Department of Planning and Development, DPD. David George is the head of that department. And they issue variances for, music events, for construction, for anything that needs a noise variance. It'll go through them. But it will vary depending on the jurisdiction, who's going to be issuing that variance.
For the light rail construction in the U District, the city has given them a 24/7 noise variance. And in talking with David George about some of the projects around town where they're jackhammering and doing other stuff with no insulation around the equipment, he says, well, we only enforce stuff after 8 p.m.
Yeah. David's interesting sometimes. I hope he doesn't see this. I love David. It's interesting, the light rail projects. There's two kind of variances. You can get a temporary variance and what they call a major public project variance. The temporary variance is kind of a free pass. And I forget what the duration is, but it's limited. So kind of the idea there is, if we'll give you a free pass, but if we're getting a lot of complaints, we won't renew that temporary variance. Where a major public project variance would have restrictions in it, basically.
Well, one of the things I tried to fight against to no avail is in Wallingford, which is on the west side of Northeast 45th, which is a major arterial, they decided after doing some pedestrian improvements that it's now a minor arterial going through Wallingford. Mm-hmm. So all of the major commercial truck traffic, including all the big dirt haulage trucks, are now running on Northeast 50th, which is predominantly a single family neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I tried to bring that up to some people and they go, well, it's just easier to do it that way. There's no consideration for the noise from those trucks.
Yeah, when we do a study, we do try to look at truck routes. A lot of times, there's a lot of possibilities for disconnects, as we see, in the way that some of these variances are written. Just because we recommend something doesn't mean it's going to be implemented. Just because it's in the code doesn't mean it's going to be enforced necessarily. you do run into, it's kind of an issue where talking to a lot of contractors, their kind of attitude with it is, we're construction and we make a lot of noise, so right, so deal with it, and then there's a lot of people who are really passionate about preserving the quiet in their neighborhood, so a lot of these issues can get pretty, emotional. And unfortunately, the way that the code is written is a problem sometimes to make sure that. And, I suppose it's this way with, any laws. You can't please everybody, so somebody's going to be upset in the end.
Take